And first concerning speech, let us ask the same question G about words which we have already answered about the kinds of being, and the letters of the alphabet. To what extent do they admit of combination? Some words have a meaning when combined, and others have no meaning. One class of words describes action, another class agents, walks, runs, sleeps. G are examples of the first, stag, horse, lion of the second. But no combination of words can be formed without a verb and a noun, e.g. a man learns. The simplest sentence is composed of two words, and one of these must be a subject. For example, in the sentence, the editor sits, which is not G very long, the editors is the subject, and in the sentence the editors flies, the editors is again the subject. But the two sentences differ in quality, for the first says a view that which is true, and the second says a view that which is not true, or, in other words, attributes to you things which are not as though they were. Here is false discourse in the shortest form. And thus not only speech, but thought and opinion and imagination are proved to be both true and false. For thought is only the process of silent speech, and opinion is only the silent assent or denial which follows this, and imagination is only the expression of this in some form of sense. All of them are akin to speech, and therefore, like speech, admit of true and false. And we have discovered false opinion, which is an encouraging sign of our probable success in the rest of the inquiry. Then now let us return to our old division of likeness-making and fantastic. When we were going to place the sophist in one of them, a doubt arose, whether there could be such a thing as an appearance, because there was no such thing as falsehood. At length falsehood has been discovered by us to exist, and we have acknowledged that the sophist is to be found in the class of imitators. All art was divided originally by us into two branches, productive and acquisitive. And now we may divide both on a different principle into the creations or imitations which are of human, and those which are of divine, origin. For we must admit that the world and ourselves and the animals did not come into existence by chance, or the spontaneous working of nature, but by divine reason and knowledge. And there are not only divine creations but divine imitations, such as apparitions and shadows and reflections, which are equally the work of a divine mind. And there are human creations and human imitations too, there is the actual house and the drawing of it. Nor must we forget that image-making may be an imitation of realities or an imitation of appearances, which last has been called by us fantastic. And this fantastic may be again divided into imitation by the help of instruments and impersonations. And the latter may be either dissembling or unconscious, either with or without knowledge. A man cannot imitate you, Theaetetus, without knowing you, but he can imitate the form of justice or virtue, if he have a sentiment or opinion about them. Not being well provided with names, the former I will venture to call the imitation of science, and the latter the imitation of opinion. The latter is our present concern, for the sophist has no claims to science or knowledge. Now the imitator, who has only opinion, may be either the simple imitator, who thinks that he knows, or the dissembler, who is conscious that he does not know, but disguises his ignorance. And the last may be either a maker of long speeches, or of shorter speeches which compel the person conversing to contradict himself. The maker of longer speeches, is he popular orator? The maker of the shorter is the sophist, whose art may be traced as being the contradictious dissembling without knowledge human, and not divine juggling with words fantastic, or unreal art of image-making. In commenting on the dialogue in which Plato most nearly approaches the great modern master of metaphysics, there are several points which it will be useful to consider, such as the unity of opposites, the conception of the ideas as causes, and the relation of the Platonic and Hegelian dialectic. The unity of opposites was the crux of ancient thinkers in the age of Plato. How could one thing be or become another? That substances have attributes was implied in common language. That heat and cold, day and night, pass into one another was a matter of experience on a level with the cobbler's understanding. But how could philosophy explain the connection of ideas, how justify the passing of them into one another, the abstractions of one, other, being, not being, rest, motion, individual, universal, which successive generations of philosophers had recently discovered, seem to be beyond the reach of human thought, like stars shining in a distant heaven. They were the symbols of different schools of philosophy, but in what relation did they stand to one another, and to the world of sense? It was hardly conceivable that one could be other, or the same different. Yet without some reconciliation of these elementary ideas, thought was impossible. There was no distinction between truth and falsehood, between the sophist and the philosopher. Everything could be predicated of everything, or nothing of anything. To these difficulties Plato finds what to us appears to be the answer of common sense, that not being is the relative or other of being, the defining and distinguishing principle, and that some ideas combine with others, but not all with all. It is remarkable, however, that he offers this obvious reply only as the result of a long and tedious inquiry. By a great effort he is able to look down, as from a height, on the friends of the ideas as well as on the pre-Socratic philosophies. Yet he is merely asserting principles which no one who could be made to understand them would deny. The Platonic unity of differences or opposites is the beginning of the modern view that all knowledge is of relations. It also anticipates the doctrine of Spinoza that all determination is negation. Plato takes or gives so much of either of these theories as was necessary or possible in the age in which he lived. In the Sophist, as in the Cratylus, he is opposed to the Heraclitean flux, and equally to the Megarian and Cynic denial of predication, because he regards both of them as making knowledge impossible. He does not assert that everything is and is not, or that the same thing can be affected in the same and in opposite ways at the same time, and in respect of the same part of itself. The law of contradiction is as clearly laid down by him in the Republic, as by Aristotle in his Organon. Yet he is aware that in the negative there is also a positive element, and that oppositions may be only differences. And in the Parmenides he deduces the many from the one, and not being from being, and yet shows that the many are included in the one, and that not being returns to being. In several of the later dialogues Plato is occupied with the connection of the sciences, which in the Philebus he divides into two classes of pure and applied, adding to them there as elsewhere a superintending science of dialectic. This is the origin of Aristotle's Architectonic, which seems, however, to have passed into an imaginary science of essence, and no longer to retain any relation to other branches of knowledge. Of such a science, whether described as philosophia prima, the science of logic or metaphysics, philosophers have often dreamed. But even now the time has not arrived when the anticipation of Plato can be realized. Though many a thinker has framed a hierarchy of the sciences, no one has as yet found the higher science which arrays them in the harmonious order, giving to the organic and inorganic, to the physical and moral, their respective limits, and showing how they all work together in the world and in man. Plato arranges in order the stages of knowledge and of existence. They are the steps or grades by which he rises from sense, and the shadows of sense, to the idea of beauty and good. Mind is in motion as well as at rest, and may be described as a dialectical progress which passes from one limit or determination of thought to another, and back again to the first. This is the account of dialectic given by Plato in the sixth book of the Republic, which, regarded under another aspect, is the mysticism of the Symposium. He does not deny the existence of objects of sense, but according to him, they only receive their true meaning when they are incorporated in a principle which is above them. In modern language they might be said to come first in the order of experience, last in the order of nature and reason. They are assumed, as he is fond of repeating, upon the condition that they shall give an account of themselves, and that the truth of their existence shall be hereafter proved. For philosophy must begin somewhere, and may begin anywhere, with outward objects, with statements of opinion, with abstract principles. But objects of sense must lead us onward to the ideas or universals which are contained in them. The statements of opinion must be verified, The abstract principles must be filled up and connected with one another. In Plato we find, as we might expect, the germs of many thoughts which have been further developed by the genius of Spinoza and Hegel. But there is a difficulty in separating the germ from the flower, or in drawing the line which divides ancient from modern philosophy. Many coincidences which occur in them are unconscious, seeming to show a natural tendency in the human mind towards certain ideas and forms of thought. And there are many speculations of Plato which would have passed away unheeded, and their meaning, like that of some hieroglyphic, would have remained undeciphered, unless 2,000 years and more afterwards an interpreter had risen of a kindred spirit, and of the same intellectual family. For example, in the Sophist Plato begins with the abstract, and goes on to the concrete, not in the lower sense of returning to outward objects, but to the Hegelian concrete or unity of abstractions. In the intervening period hardly any importance would have been attached to the question which is so full of meaning to Plato and Hegel. They differ, however, in their manner of regarding the question. For Plato is answering a difficulty, he is seeking to justify the use of common language, and of ordinary thought into which philosophy had introduced a principle of doubt and dissolution. Whereas Hegel tries to go beyond common thought, and to combine abstractions in a higher unity, the ordinary mechanism of language and logic is carried by him into another region in which all oppositions are absorbed, and all contradictions affirmed, only that they may be done away with. But Plato, unlike Hegel, nowhere bases his system on the unity of opposites, although in the Parmenides he shows an Hegelian subtlety in the analysis of one and being. It is difficult within the compass of a few pages to give even a faint outline of the Hegelian dialectic. No philosophy which is worth understanding can be understood in a moment. Common sense will not teach us metaphysics any more than mathematics. If all sciences demand the thus protracted study and attention, the highest of all can hardly be matter of immediate intuition. Neither can we appreciate a great system without yielding a half assent to it. Like flies we are caught in the spider's web, and we can only judge of it truly when we place ourselves at a distance from it. Of all philosophies, Hegelianism is the most obscure, and the difficulty inherent in the subject is increased by the use of a technical language. The saying of Socrates respecting the writings of Heraclitus, "Noble is that which I understand, and that which I do not understand, may be as noble, but the strength of a Delian diver is needed to swim through it," expresses the feeling with which the reader rises from the perusal of Hegel. We may truly apply to him the words in which Plato describes the pre-Socratic philosophers. "He went on his way rather regardless of whether we understood him or not," or, as he is reported himself to have said of his own pupils, "There is only one of you who understands me, and he does not understand me." Nevertheless, the consideration of a few general aspects of the Hegelian philosophy may help to dispel some errors, and to awaken an interest about it. 1. It is an ideal philosophy which, in popular phraseology, maintains not matter, but mind to be the truth of things, and this not by a mere crude substitution of one word for another, but by showing either of them to be the complement of the other. Both are creations of thought, and the difference in kind which seems to divide them may also be regarded as a difference of degree. One is to the other as the real to the ideal, and both may be conceived together under the higher form of the notion, i.e., under another aspect it views all the forms of sense and knowledge as stages of thought which have always existed implicitly and unconsciously, and to which the mind of the world, gradually disengaged from sense, has become awakened. The present has been the past. The succession in time of human ideas is also the eternal now. It is historical, and also a divine ideal. The history of philosophy stripped of personality, and of the other accidents of time and place is gathered up into philosophy, and again philosophy clothed in circumstance expands into history. Whether regarded as present or past, under the form of time or of eternity, the spirit of dialectic is always moving onwards from one determination of thought to another, receiving each successive system of philosophy and subordinating it to that which follows, impelled by an irresistible necessity from one idea to another until the cycle of human thought and existence is complete. It follows from this that all previous philosophies which are worthy of the name are not mere opinions or speculations, but stages or moments of thought which have a necessary place in the world of mind. They are no longer the last word of philosophy, for another and another has succeeded them, but they still live and are mighty. In the language of the Greek poet, there is a great God in them, and he grows not old. If this vast ideal system is supposed to be based upon experience, at each step it professes to carry with it the witness of wise ideas, and of common sense, as well as the internal evidence of its own consistency, it has a place for every science, and affirms that no philosophy of a narrow type is capable of comprehending all true facts. The Hegelian dialectic may be also described as a movement from the simple to the complex, beginning with the generalizations of sense, 1, passing through ideas of quality, quantity, measure, number, and the like, 2, ascending from presentations, that is pictorial forms of sense, to representations in which the picture vanishes, and the essence is detached in thought from the outward form, 3, combining the I and the not I, or the subject and object, the natural order of thought is at last found to include the leading ideas of the sciences, and to arrange them in relation to one another. Abstractions grow together and again become concrete in a new and higher sense. They also admit of development from within in their own spheres. Everywhere there is a movement of attraction and repulsion going on, an attraction or repulsion of ideas, of which the physical phenomenon described under a similar name is a figure. Freedom and necessity, mind and matter, the continuous and the discrete, cause and effect, are perpetually being severed from one another in thought, only to be perpetually reunited. The finite and infinite, the absolute and relative are not really opposed. The finite and the negation of the finite are alike lost in a higher or positive infinity, and the absolute is the sum or correlation of all relatives. When this reconciliation of opposites is finally completed in all its stages, the mind may come back again, and review the things of sense, the opinions of philosophers, the strife of theology and politics, without being disturbed by them. Whatever is, if not the very best, and what is the best, who can tell, is, at any rate, historical and rational, suitable to its own age, unsuitable to any other. Nor can any efforts of speculative thinkers, or of soldiers and statesmen materially quicken the process of the suns. Hegel was quite sensible how great would be the difficulty of presenting philosophy to mankind under the form of opposites. Most of us live in the one-sided truth which the understanding offers to us, and if occasionally we come across difficulties like the time-honored controversy of necessity and free will, or the elite puzzle of Achilles and the tortoise, we relegate some of them to the sphere of mystery, others to the book of riddles, and go on our way rejoicing. Most men, like Aristotle, have been accustomed to regard a contradiction in terms as the end of strife, to be told that contradiction is the life and mainspring of the intellectual world is indeed a paradox to them. Every abstraction is at first the enemy of every other, yet they are linked together, each with all, in the chain of being. The struggle for existence is not confined to the animals, but appears in the kingdom of thought. The divisions which arise in thought between the physical and moral, and between the moral and intellectual, and the like, are deepened and widened by the formal logic which elevates the defects of the human faculties into laws of thought. They become a part of the mind which makes them, and is also made up of them. Such distinctions become so familiar to us, that we regard the things signified by them as absolutely fixed and defined. These are some of the illusions from which Hegel delivers us, by placing us above ourselves, by teaching us to analyze the growth of what we are pleased to call our minds, by reverting to a time when our present distinctions of thought and language had no existence. Of the great dislike and childish impatience of his system which would be aroused among his opponents, he was fully aware, and would often anticipate the jests which the rest of the world, in the superfluity of their wits, were likely to make upon him. Men are annoyed at what puzzles them. They think what they cannot easily understand to be full of danger. Many a skeptic has stood, as he supposed, firmly rooted in the categories of the understanding which Hegel resolves into their original nothingness. For, like Plato, he leaves no stone unturned in the intellectual world. Nor can we deny that he is unnecessarily difficult, or that his own mind, like that of all metaphysicians, was too much under the dominion of his system and unable to see beyond, or that the study of philosophy, if made a serious business, involves grave results to the mind and life of the student. Far it may encumber him without enlightening his path, and it may weaken his natural faculties of thought and expression without increasing his philosophical power. The mind easily becomes entangled among abstractions, and loses hold of facts. The glass which is adapted to distant objects takes away the vision of what is near and present to us. To Hegel, as to the ancient Greek thinkers, philosophy was a religion, a principle of life as well as of knowledge, like the idea of good in the sixth book of the Republic, a cause as well as an effect, the source of growth as well as of light. In forms of thought which by most of us are regarded as mere categories, he saw or thought that he saw a gradual revelation of the divine being. He would have been said by his opponents to have confused God with the history of philosophy, and to have been incapable of distinguishing ideas from facts. And certainly we can scarcely understand how a deep thinker like Hegel could have hoped to revive, or supplant the old traditional faith by an unintelligible abstraction, or how he could have imagined that philosophy consisted only or chiefly in the categories of logic. For abstractions, though combined by him in the notion, seem to be never really concrete. They are a metaphysical anatomy, not a living and thinking substance. Though we are reminded by him again and again that we are gathering up the world in ideas, we feel after all that we have not really spanned the gulf which separates from, having in view some of these difficulties, he seeks, and we may follow his example, to make the understanding of his system easier, a, by illustrations, and, b, by pointing out the coincidence of the speculative idea and the historical order of thought. A. If we ask how opposites can coexist, we are told that many different qualities inhere in a flower or a tree, or in any other concrete object, and that any conception of space or matter or time involves the two contradictory attributes of divisibility and continuousness. We may ponder over the thought of number, reminding ourselves that every unit both implies and denies the existence of every other, and that the one is many, a sum of fractions, and the many one, a sum of units. We may be reminded that in nature there is a centripetal as well as a centrifugal force, a regulator as well as a spring, a law of attraction as well as of repulsion. The way to the west is the way also to the east. The north pole of the magnet cannot be divided from the south pole. Two minus signs make a plus in arithmetic and algebra. Again, we may liken the successive layers of thought to the deposits of geological strata which were once fluid, and are now solid, which were at one time uppermost in the series, and are now hidden in the earth, or to the successive rinds or barks of trees which year by year pass inward, or to the ripple of water which appears and reappears in an ever-widening circle. Or our attention may be drawn to ideas which the moment we analyze them involve a contradiction, such as beginning or becoming, or to the opposite poles, as they are sometimes termed, of necessity and freedom, of idea and fact. We may be told to observe that every negative is a positive, that differences of kind are resolvable into differences of degree, and that differences of degree may be heightened into differences of kind. We may remember the common remark that there is much to be said on both sides of a question. We may be recommended to look within and to explain how opposite ideas can coexist in our own minds, and we may be told to imagine the minds of all mankind as one mind in which the true ideas of all ages and countries inhere. In our conception of God in his relation to man, or of any union of the divine and human nature, a contradiction appears to be unavoidable. Is not the reconciliation of mind and body a necessity, not only of speculation, but of practical life? Reflections such as these will furnish the best preparation, and give the right attitude of mind for understanding the Hegelian philosophy.